Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Daniel chapter 3, which I will entitle Nebuchadnezzar's Golden Statue in the Fiery Furnace. We have just concluded in chapter 2, Daniel's interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, a dream of a four metal statue, which was smashed by the fifth kingdom, the fifth monarchy, the stone, which is the kingdom of Christ, the church. And now we're going to embark here in chapter 3 on a story of government oppression, pagan government oppression against faith in Yahweh. Now, when was this? There's considerable debate as to whether this incident took place soon after the first vision of the four metal statue in the last chapter, or not. That previous vision in the last chapter was somewhere around 602 in the third year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, using Babylonian reckoning. Nebuchadnezzar's dates are given as 605 to 562. If you start in 604, 604, 603, 602, so somewhere around 602. But it's not clear whether the vision was given at exactly that time or later. It really doesn't matter. We start in verse 1, Daniel 3. King Nebuchadnezzar made a gold statue, 90 feet high and 9 feet wide. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Now, apparently Nebuchadnezzar didn't like Daniel's first vision. That was in the previous chapter. You recall the statue in Nebuchadnezzar's dream that Daniel interpreted had a head of gold, chest and arms of silver, stomach and thighs of bronze, legs and of iron, representing respectively, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Alexander the Great and his successor kingdoms, and the Roman Empire. And apparently Nebuchadnezzar didn't like the fact that this four metal statue got smashed by a stone that broke off from a mountain representing the kingdom of God. So Nebuchadnezzar made the entire statue of gold, not just the head, but the whole statue. That's a speculation, but it's an interesting speculation I garnered from one of my commentators. Now this statue, 90 feet high and 9 feet wide. I'm using the Holman Christian Standard Bible because it gives measurements in English measurements, which I'm used to. That's pretty high if you think about it. A 90-foot high statue, 9 feet wide, that could not be solid gold. It had to be wood overlaid with gold, which is a common construction technique in the ancient world. Now, verse 1 says it's a statue, but it was probably a stylized obelisk, not a normal statue. What kind of a statue is 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide? It sounds like an obelisk. Now, this statue was set up by Nebuchadnezzar in the plain of Dura. Where is that? Here's a quote from BibleAtlas.org. Opert placed it to the southeast of Babylon near a small river and mounds bearing the name of Duair or Duair, D-O-U-A-I-R or D-U-A-I-R, where also was what seemed to be the base of a great statue. Now, I don't know who Opert was, some archaeologist, but that sounds pretty good. But others have believed the name Dura to indicate a portion of the actual site of Babylon within the great wall of the city, wall being Duru. So it's either within Babylon or close to Babylon. That makes sense because that's where Nebuchadnezzar's capital city was, and that's where Daniel was working at the time. If you recall from the previous chapter, Daniel's working in Babylon, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Hananiah, Meshach, and Azariah, they had been assigned to the provinces outside of Babylon for their administrative duty. We go down to Daniel 3, verses 2 through 3. King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to assemble the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to attend the dedication of the statue King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces assembled for the dedication of the statue the king had set up. Then they stood before the statue Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Daniel is sort of redundant in his style here. He repeats, satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates. Why didn't he just say they assembled? I don't know. At any rate, this styling of the government official shows that every possible government official that was in the kingdom was called. This was a big deal, in other words. Why did Nebuchadnezzar send for all these people to assemble before this golden image? Well, it was for the purpose of testing the allegiance of all his officials, of course, because if you bow down to the statue, you're bowing down to Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar can sleep at night. He won't have to worry about getting stabbed in the back by disgruntled officials. We go now to Daniel 3, verses 4 through 6. A herald loudly proclaimed, people of every nation and language, you are commanded, when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, drum, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the gold statue that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. But whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a furnace of blazing fire. Now, why did the herald say people of every nation? Isn't it just one nation, the Babylonian nation? Well, we need to remember that the Babylonian Empire had many constituent people groups. That's what nation means. It means people group. So that's not surprising. Now, all the musical instruments that are mentioned, that shows, again, it's a big deal, a big ceremonial event going on here. I'm not going to go through all the instruments. I've learned that when you go from language to language, there are several things that don't translate well. One of them is rocks, chrysolite, beryl, topaz, forget it. Another thing is food. I learned that in China. You just use the Chinese word because we don't have that kind of food over here. And likewise with musical instruments. I mean, King James, I think, has bagpipes and psalter. What's a bagpipe doing in Babylon? Bagpipes are in Scotland. So we're not going to worry about that. A zither is mentioned. That's a Chinese instrument, by the way, and I know what it looks like, but I'm not going to try to explain it. I know what it sounds like, too. But again, my point is that people don't know what these instruments are, and it doesn't matter. The point is that it was an orchestra, because this was a big ceremonial occasion. And at the sound, when the music sounded, everybody was supposed to fall down, plant their foreheads on the ground, and worship this golden image. And of course, they all did it, not because they believed there was a god behind that image, but because they were subjecting themselves to the political authority of King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, here we have the archetypical conflict between government power and individual religious conscience. That's a big deal here in America now, as people are losing their jobs when they refuse to not tell parents that their pagan school district is forcing kids into transgender professions, maybe even getting so-called gender-affirming care, which means getting their penises chopped off or their breasts chopped off in an early age without their parents' permission. And so there are many, many school districts in this country right now in America doing that, and there's a big revolt amongst parents against that. But there you have it. Now, most of these parents are probably not Christians, because if they have any sense, they wouldn't put their kids in these disgusting public schools anyway, which spend all of their time blasting Christianity, either by omission or even overtly, explicitly blaspheming God. Depends on which school district you're in. But at any rate, there's your conflict. It's a conflict that happens to Chinese Christians all the time. I remember talking to a Chinese believer who had been run out of his mother's church in Shanghai, fled all the way to the west of China, to Xinjiang province. He had been captured at some point in his life. He had been put into a jail cell with murderers and rapists, a little tiny room with an uncovered squatty potty at the end of it, which was never cleaned. And twice a day, I think he said it was, he would be taken to the guardhouse, where he was beaten with an old-fashioned telephone that was swung around on the wire, smashed into his head. He had his groin prodded with an electric cattle prod, and he was put in to a square, cement square in the hot sun, where he squatted down. He was forced to squat down in a gong fu position and stay there until he felt his throat closing up and he thought he was going to die. But of course, he's not going to renounce Jesus. So that's an extreme version of this conflict that happens. And here's an extreme version too. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they had a choice. They could either bow down to that golden image, or they could get thrown into a furnace of blazing fire. Now, not worshiping this golden statue was really more than a religious offense. It was a political offense, obviously, as I've said. Now, one little note concerning the late-date liberals who want to say that Daniel's not a prophet but a pious fraud, writing in the Maccabean era in the 2nd century B.C. rather than in the 6th century B.C., during the time of Nebuchadnezzar, these liberals say that three of the names of these musical instruments that are listed are Aramaic words borrowed from the Greek. And the argument goes, these Greek words, these Greek instruments would not be available to Daniel in the 6th century B.C. They didn't show up until after the Greek kingdoms, after Alexander the Great, the Seleucid kingdoms, and so forth in the 2nd century B.C. in the Maccabean era. Now, David Guzik, God bless his dispensational little soul, has a quote Concerning that, he says, ancient records tell us there were Greeks in the region of Assyria, Babylon, and Persia as far back as the 8th century B.C. Remember, Daniel's in the 6th century B.C. So there were Greeks there. Archaeology also proves beyond a doubt that Greek mercenaries fought and made military settlements in and around Judea before the time of Daniel. So the Greeks were around even before the Maccabean period. So we're not going to pay any attention to these blasphemers, these liberals, who say that Daniel was not a prophet, but a pious fraud. We go down to Daniel 3, verses 7 through 12. Therefore, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and every kind of music, people of every nation and language fell down and worshipped the gold statue that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Some Chaldeans took this occasion to come forward and maliciously accuse the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "May the king live forever. You, as king, have issued a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, drum, and every kind of music must fall down and worship the gold statue." I don't know why Daniel keeps listing over and over again that long list of musical instruments, but he does. Verse 11, Daniel 3, "Whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a furnace of blazing fire." This is the Chaldeans, the soothsayers, the mediums, repeating Nebuchadnezzar's decree. Verse 12, the Chaldeans, who are the soothsayers, they continue, "There are some Jews you have appointed to manage the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men have ignored you, the king. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold statue you have set up." Now these Chaldeans, verse 8, they are not all Babylonians. The word Chaldeans is normally used to refer to the race of the Babylonians, but in Daniel here it's used as a soothsayer. The words are very similar. In fact, the word for soothsayer and the word for an ethnic Babylonian, Kasdur, I think it is in Babylonian, those two words are homonyms. So when it gets translated into English, basically, it's the same word. Now, these soothsayers, these Chaldeans, had political motivations because Daniel and his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they had been promoted over these Chaldeans. So they don't like these guys. Now, if the Chaldeans had kept their mouths shut, probably no one would have noticed that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were not bowing down. Why? There were thousands of officials there in the plain of Dura in front of that gold statue. Nobody would have noticed that they were still standing. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego didn't call attention to themselves. They didn't make a formal protest against Nebuchadnezzar's idolatry. They just refused to participate in a crowd. That reminds me of what happened in my instance of being confronted by state anti-Christian authority. I was the second person, the salutatorian, in my high school graduation time. The salutatorian was supposed to do the devotional. I said, fine. When they found out I was going to mention Jesus, they said, you can't mention Jesus. I said, we'll get somebody else. I wasn't going to make a formal protest against the public school system. I just backed out. I said, no, I'm not going to do it. Find somebody else. Well, they weren't content with that. You can't do that. This is an honor. You can't back out. It might offend people. And what they were referring to was not secular people, but in my hometown, we had a large contingent of Jews. In fact, my hometown is famous for toleration of Jews. I found out later from a Jewish guy who lived there, I believe. That's where I heard it. And I said, well, if it offends Jews, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to not live Jesus out. And I said, I had a Jewish friend named Betty. I wasn't close to her, but I knew her. And I said, well, just let Betty do it. She's not going to mention Jesus. Of course, that might offend Christians, but that's okay, you know. No, that wasn't good enough. So finally, I got mad. Unfortunately, I uttered a profanity as I was being grilled at the home of the principal and vice principal. This was after the number three person in the class, who was logically in line to step up and be number two and give the devotional. She was a Christian, too. I didn't know her. I remember her name to this day. But finally, she caved in and said she would do it without mentioning the name of Jesus, and so she did it. I hope she has found forgiveness after that later, because I really don't think you ought to do stuff like that. And so I just walked out of the house and went home. And then I realized, you know, the state doesn't like me as a Christian. And I turned my back on the public school system. I graduated from it after that, went to the graduation ceremony, and haven't looked back. None of my kids went there. None of my grandkids are going to public schools. Of course, I don't have control over my grandkids, but fortunately, they're not in those public schools because the state runs those schools and the state does not like Jesus. This is everywhere, China, America, you name it. There is always unjust authority coming down on top of the church's head. And here, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were just trying to be quiet. They weren't raising a ruckus. I don't think you should. I remember in China, people had different ideas about what to do, given the persecutory situation. I know some people would go into a classroom and just talk about Jesus, and they get shipped out very soon, 48 hours. Oh, but I don't have a flight out. Too bad. Oh, I can't get my furniture sold. Too bad. I can't get my money out of the bank account. Too bad. You're out of the country. I think that's stupid. Be careful. My strategy was you be careful in the classroom and then talk privately outside where the commies can't hear you. And of course, that works for a while, but finally the commies in a particular city informed my university I was having Christian meetings in my apartment, not in their classrooms, but it was in my apartment that belonged to the university. And so they said, "Saranara," and they kicked me out. So this happens all the time. This is what Charles Spurgeon says about this. You will not be able to go through life without being discovered. A lighted candle cannot be hid. There is a feeling among some good people that it will be wise to be very reticent and hide their light under a bushel. They intend to lie low all the wartime and come out when the palms are being distributed. They hope to travel to heaven by the back lanes and skulk into glory in disguise. Ah me, what a degenerate set. Well, those are some harsh words from Mr. Spurgeon, and I'll be honest with you. As I sit in America watching the persecution of the church increase day by day, I have had thoughts like a member of a degenerate set. I have had thoughts about just kind of waiting out the last few years of my life, going to heaven without suffering persecution. Nobody likes it. I don't think you should seek out persecution. I know in the Middle Ages, the church had to stop people who were deliberately putting themselves in harm's way so they could get martyred and get a martyr's crown. Well, that's just plain stupid. I mean, Jesus told the Christians in the Olivet Discourse, when you see the abomination of desolation, i.e. the Roman army, don't stand there and get murdered by them. Head for the hills. Flee. Nothing wrong with doing that. But if you get to a spot where you can't avoid the conflict with the persecuting state, you have to stand firm with Jesus and profess his name and not renounce him. That's just the way it is. Now in verse 12, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego got accused by the Chaldeans, the soothsayers, before Nebuchadnezzar. Why didn't the Chaldeans accuse Daniel too? John Gill says it might be because of several possibilities. One, Daniel was above Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He was a big shot in the kingdom now, and so he was out of their reach. In the last chapter, we saw that the king himself had ordered an oblation to be offered to Daniel, offered him incense. Daniel was walking in high cotton after he interpreted the king's four metal statue dream in the last chapter. So that's probably the reason. Another possible reason, he wasn't there because he was sick. Well, maybe. Or he was not there because he was on the king's business elsewhere. Well, maybe. But I don't think so. I think it's because the Chaldeans were scared to mess with Daniel, so they went after the smaller fry. We go now to Daniel 3, verses 13 through 15. Then in a furious rage, Nebuchadnezzar gave orders to bring in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Remember, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they governed in the provinces of the Babylonian Empire. They weren't in the city, except they had come to the city so they could participate in this worship of the golden statue. So the three men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar asked them, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, is it true that you don't serve my gods or worship the gold statue I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of, here we go again, flute, horn, zither, lyre, harp, drum, and every kind of music, fall down and worship the statue I made. But if you don't worship it, you will immediately be thrown into a furnace of blazing fire. And who is the God who could rescue you from my power?" In other words, Nebuchadnezzar says, he's an arrogant guy. He says, "I've got you, boys. You better bow down before me." Nebuchadnezzar didn't count on the overwhelming power and majesty and might of Yahweh. Now, in verse 14, Nebuchadnezzar first asked the three Jewish officials, "Is it true that you don't serve my gods?" To his credit, Nebuchadnezzar didn't just believe the accusation without investigation. But now, notice how Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, notice how they are now in a worse situation than when they were hidden amongst all those thousands of officials bowing down to the golden idol. They are now alone in front of the emperor himself, and they were asked a direct question from the king. That's worse than refusing to bow to a statue in the midst of thousands of officials. It's worse to be in the presence of the emperor personally and say, yep, it's true. We didn't bow down. Well, of course, they didn't bow down. Now, Nebuchadnezzar in verse 15 says, who is the God who can rescue you? Well, actually, there was no God except for one. As we will see, that's Yahweh, the God of gods, the Lord of lords, the maker and creator of the universe. Now, Nebuchadnezzar was proud. He could not tolerate losing face here. You mean my officials are not going to bow down to my idol after I made such a big deal about it and threatened capital punishment? I've threatened to throw into a blazing furnace anybody who doesn't bow down before this idol, and here I have three prominent officials who are not bowing down. He was sort of in a bad place. He'd made a stupid command, stupid from God's point of view and our point of view, not from his point of view, I guess. And if he had allowed those three officials to not bow down, it would have made Nebuchadnezzar look terrible politically. It would have made him look weak. Now, Guzik, the commentator, says that Nebuchadnezzar was more of a secularist or a humanist than a theist. In other words, he was more interested in politics than religion. And I think that's probably true, but I do question this a little bit. Some ancient Near Eastern kings, I'm sure, believed in the gods that they had set up over their kingdoms or over their city-states. But Nebuchadnezzar, even though this is a political thing with him, he is mocking all the gods who can't rescue the three Jewish officials. Who is the God that can do this? He wasn't just mocking the God of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He was mocking all the gods because he's a big shot. He's in charge. He's the emperor. Now notice the response. Verse 18 is key. The three men, well, first in verse 16, they said, Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to give you an answer. The reason they don't need to give Nebuchadnezzar an answer is because, yes, it was true. They didn't bow down, so there's no use denying that. But then in verse 18, they say, but even if Yahweh, he, does not rescue us, they are allowing for the possibility that they might get burnt up in that fire. Now, the reason I like this verse so much is because it's the perfect verse to answer the Market and Parkett Copeland Haganites, the Word of Faith people, who are always saying, oh, negative confessions will doom you. You need to say something positive. This is a negative confession. In verse 18, the three Jewish officials are saying that there's a possibility that God will not rescue them. But even allowing that possibility, Nebuchadnezzar, know this, we're not going to worship that gold statue. The three Jewish boys, or young men, they didn't presume to know God's will. Unfortunately, the Copenhagenites do presume to know God's will when they say, oh, move that tornado out of the path that is heading toward the house. You don't know what God's will is for that tornado. Azariah, Mishael, and Hananiah were going to do what was right even if God didn't do what they hoped he would do. Similar to Job. Job said in chapter 13, verse 15, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. So we need to allow for God to let negative things happen to us, knowing that God will take the negative things and work them to your good if you love the Lord, Romans 8:28. Now, we don't like that. Of course, nobody likes that. But let's face it, a lot of times bad things happen to you and they turn out to be pretty good in the long run. I think of one young lady I wanted to marry and God kept saying no, 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 and she kept saying no, 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 and I kept getting my head bashed in romantically in the romantic wars, and thank God, as Garth Brooks once said, thank God for unanswered prayers. Sometimes you need negative things to happen to you. And look at the negative thing that happened to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. People are still talking about them 2,500 years later in Sunday school classes. They're famous. God got great glory. Nebuchadnezzar ended up praising God because of what he saw in the fiery furnace. So we go now to Daniel 3, verses 19 through 23. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with rage, and the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And by the way, those are the Babylonian names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. I hope I've got that in the right order. Those are the three Hebrew names. Nebuchadnezzar's face changed. He gave orders to heat the furnace seven times more than was customary, and he commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the furnace of blazing fire. So these men, in their trousers, robes, head coverings, and other clothes, were tied up and thrown into the furnace of blazing fire. Since the king's command was so urgent and the furnace extremely hot, the raging flames killed those men who carried Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego up. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the furnace of blazing fire. Now, in verse 19, Nebuchadnezzar's face changed. Before, Nebuchadnezzar might have been giving his three Jewish officials fatherly advice to submit. Now, let's don't be hard-headed about this. It's just a political act. Bow down before the idol. No big deal. You're good officials. You've proven yourself to be faithful and loyal servants. Why let a little thing like idolatry get in the way of your service to me? But then, when they said, nope, you can throw us in the fire if you want to, but we're not going to bow down. Ooh, that looked like obstinance. And so Nebuchadnezzar was filled with rage. And that's why his face changed. The expression on his face changed. Went from good to bad. So he ordered his officials to heat the furnace up 7 times more than was customary. And all that did was to make the escape from the furnace even more miraculous. And then he got some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up the 3 Jewish officials. Strong soldiers, because we've got to be sure that they don't get out. They don't escape before we throw them into the fire. And all that did was to make the escape even more miraculous. And so in verse 22, the king's command was so urgent and the furnace so hot, the raging flames killed those men who carried Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego up. And the fact that those men were killed in a fire that was too hot for the furnace, that also made the deliverance of the 3 Jewish officials even more miraculous. Now, we need to talk about this fiery furnace. If you think of a furnace, if you're like me, you think of a brick enclosed small building with a hot fire in the middle of it and with a door in the front of it. But that's not what it was, I don't think. There are several aspects of this story that show that the furnace was an open pit, not an enclosed structure. 4 things to prove that. In verse 23, the 3 Jewish men fell into the furnace. Let me read that again. Verse 23, and these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the furnace of blazing fire. How do you fall into a furnace if it's a brick building with a door in the front? But you could fall into a pit. Second item that proves that it was an open pit, the soldiers were killed by the fire. How could they be killed by a fire in an enclosed furnace? But if they're on the edge of a pit trying to throw their 3 captives in the fire and the fire blazes up and catches them as they're throwing them in, that's how they could get killed. Third proof that the furnace was an open pit. In verse 25, we see that Nebuchadnezzar was able to see the 3 men plus the 4th man walking in the flames. In verse 25, we read this. Nebuchadnezzar exclaimed, look, I see 4 men, not tied, walking around in the fire unharmed. Well, it's easy to look down into a pit and see men walking around, much easier than looking through a door. It's possible, but it's easier to look down into a pit. And also, the 4th detail of this story that tends to show that the fiery furnace was a pit, the 3 men could hear Nebuchadnezzar when he called. We read in verse 26, Nebuchadnezzar approached the furnace of blazing fire and called, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out. So they heard. Now there's a translation issue that might cut against my idea that this was an open pit. Verse 26 in the Holman Christian Study Bible says, Nebuchadnezzar then approached the door of the furnace. And several other translations have door. And of course, an open pit doesn't have a door. That sounds like it would be the door to an enclosed brick building. But other translations would solve that problem. The American Standard Version and the King James Version have the mouth of the furnace. Nebuchadnezzar then approached the mouth of the furnace. The Darby and the New American Bible have the opening of the furnace. And of course, the opening would be the top open area of the pit. We're going to add to Daniel 3, verses 24 through 25. Then King Nebuchadnezzar jumped up in alarm. He said to his advisors, didn't we throw 3 men bound into the fire? Yes, of course, your majesty, they replied to the king. He exclaimed, look, I see 4 men, not tied, walking around in the fire unharmed, and the 4th looks like a son of the gods. Now, why did Nebuchadnezzar in verse 24 jump up in alarm? Well, first of all, his soldiers had gotten killed at the furnace. Second of all, the 3 men are still alive inside, and they should have been burnt up. And fourth of all, there was a 4th man who looks like a son of the gods in there. No wonder Nebuchadnezzar was shaken up. In verse 25, Nebuchadnezzar says the 4 men are not tied. The first 3 men, of course, were tied, but now they weren't, so this had to be miraculous. And what was miraculous about it, the only thing that did burn was the rope. Everything else, the clothes, the people, did not burn. And then he says that the fourth man looks like a son of the gods. The King James translates that as the Son of God, which I don't believe is the proper translation. Elohim is probably the word for gods there. I didn't look it up, but I'm sure it is. And Elohim can be translated as a plural. Im in Hebrew is plural, so it could be plural gods. But the plural word for gods is also used for the true God, Yahweh, Elohim. Well, the King James, I think, is jumping the gun a little bit, because the Son of the gods, the fourth man that's walking around in that fire, has to be Jesus, a theophany. I don't think Nebuchadnezzar meant it to be Jesus, because he didn't know Jesus. When he said a son of the gods, he meant someone sprung from and sent by the gods. Son of the gods. Now notice that this son of the gods looked differently. The first three are just walking around unharmed, not tied up. That's miraculous enough. But the fourth one looked like a son of the gods. I suspect he had a little bit of that Shekinah glory on him. He was effulgent. He was glorious. He was iridescent. He was shining. That was Jesus. We move now to Daniel 3, verses 26 through 27. Nebuchadnezzar then approached the door of the furnace of blazing fire, let's say the mouth or the opening of the furnace of blazing fire, and called, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you servants of the Most High God, come out." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire. When the satraps, prefects, governors, and the king's advisors gathered around, they saw that the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men. Not a hair of their heads was singed. Their robes were unaffected, and there was no smell of fire on them. Now notice that when Nebuchadnezzar calls out to the three Jewish officials, he calls them servants of the Most High God. Nebuchadnezzar here recognizes God for who he is after seeing God exert his power, the Most High God. Now, I question, maybe Nebuchadnezzar had heard that the Hebrews served the Most High God. He was familiar with Jews, of course. So maybe he might have called the three servants of the Most High God even before seeing the miracle here. But for whatever reason that he used the name of the Most High God, this shows that Nebuchadnezzar unwillingly is giving praise and honor to Yahweh because of Yahweh's magnificent power. This was an incredible miracle here. Now in verse 27, we read that the robes of the three men were unaffected, not burnt by the fire. Another miracle. This is why the clothing details are mentioned back in verse 21, Daniel 3:21. So these men in their trousers, robes, head coverings, and other clothes, again, a lot of detail is really not necessary except to show that they weren't burnt up. There was no smell of fire on them. It's one thing not to be burnt, but not to even smell like you've been in a fire. Now that's quite a miracle. We go now to Daniel 3, verse 28. Nebuchadnezzar exclaimed, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He sent his angel and rescued his servants who trusted in him. They violated the king's command and risked their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God." Now this is all Nebuchadnezzar speaking. He's giving glory to God. He didn't recognize the true God as his God, of course, but he's still giving glory to God. Nebuchadnezzar says that God sent an angel. He figured an angel had something to do with the deliverance in the furnace. Maybe so, maybe not. Perhaps he's referring to that fourth man as an angel. Nebuchadnezzar, here in verse 28, openly admits that the three violated the king's command. He wasn't too proud to fail to mention that. He mentions it, despite his pride. And then in the Holman Christian Study Bible, Nebuchadnezzar says the three risked their lives. Well, other translations have they yielded their bodies. In fact, most translations say that the three yielded their bodies, which I think is a much better translation than risked their lives. Here are several translations that translate as yielded their bodies. The American Standard Version, Bible in Basic English, Darby, KJV, the New American Bible, Young's Literal Translation, and the New American Standard Bible all have the three risked their lives. Now this is a perfect example of Romans 12:1. Which says, "Therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, I urge you to present your bodies as a living sacrifice." Now, if you think about it, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah presented their bodies as a living sacrifice when they laid themselves open to the wrath of King Nebuchadnezzar to get thrown into the hot fire. We go now to Daniel 3, verses 29 and 30, and we will finish this chapter. Nebuchadnezzar continues to speak, and he says, "Therefore I issue a decree that anyone of any people, nation, or language who says anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego will be torn limb from limb and his house made a garbage dump. For there is no other God who is able to deliver like this." Then the king rewarded Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So instead of getting burnt up, they get promoted. That's what God can do when you're being persecuted by a pagan government, or by a pagan boss, or by a pagan husband, or by a pagan wife, or whoever is on your case because of your Christianity. God can not only deliver you, he can promote you. Now notice this decree that anybody that says anything offensive, in other words, anybody that blasphemes Yahweh, the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the king's going to tear them limb from limb, you know, put them in the middle of four trees, each limb tied to one of the trees, and then the rope is cut and the trees spring back to an upright position. And meanwhile, the poor victim is ripped limb from limb, and then his house made a garbage dump. His house will be torn down. Now, the three Jewish officials probably didn't want the king to do that. Of course, they don't believe in a coerced state religion. It wouldn't be a state religion, but it would be sort of an extreme support of the religion of Yahweh. Coerced worship of God is never good. So they probably wouldn't want something like that to happen. I will have to confess, I did think about America. Would it be nice to have a decree that says that anybody that blasphemes or takes the name of God in vain in America will be torn limb from limb? There wouldn't be anybody left. Every time you watch a movie, "Oh my God, oh my God." Hey, and it's not just pagans that are doing that. Christians who ought to know better are constantly saying, "Oh my God, oh my God." They're talking about the maker of the universe and just throwing his name around like that. That is a direct violation of the Ten Commandments. Now, I know that we're not under the Ten Commandments, but Jesus says, "Hallowed be thy name." This is how you're supposed to pray. Hallowed be the name. That means holy is the name. And when you just go around saying, "Oh my God, that's not holy," maybe we should have a decree that you get torn limb from limb if you take God's name in vain. I'm just exaggerating for effect here, folks. Don't take me literally. And we are now finished with Daniel 3, and we are prepared to go to Daniel 4, which I will call Nebuchadnezzar's second dream of a chopped down tree. That's a little bit misleading. He didn't have two dreams about a chopped down tree. He had one dream of a four metal statue, and now he's going to have a dream about a tree that was chopped down. That tree, of course, is going to be himself. So we'll see you in the next chapter, Daniel chapter 4. Hope you enjoyed this audio.